Good morning, everyone. Hello. Hello. Please don't be like my first year students. Be alive. So my name's James. Vanathakis is up there. I want to begin by thanking Alistair for that warm introduction, thanking Lee for a wonderful job she's done in organising this this conference. I also want to acknowledge, of course, most importantly, the traditional owners of this land. I want to thank Jack, I'm not sure he's probably gone, for his really warm and powerful welcome to country. And I want to pay respects to elders past, present, and of course, from the potentially for future. I want to thank also Professor Saint for, I think, setting the scene really well for what we're here to discuss today. I spoke at a conference, it was the week before, which was the postgraduate experience conference. And a lot of what I want to talk about today is inspired from that conference. I was also lucky enough to attend the D-Dogs meeting yesterday. The D-Dogs have changed their name. I don't know why. I think D-Dog sounds so much cooler than Australian Council or something. It sounds more like a star chamber. But people say to you a D-Dog, and it makes you feel like you're some sort of secret club. So I like being a D-Dog. So where to begin? I usually begin, and for those of you who were at the Postgraduate Experience Conference, you heard this story before, so I do apologise. But I usually begin my presentations when I talk about my first day at uni as an undergraduate, where being the first member of my family at university, I asked my mum what to take, and she told me to pack my passport so people would know who I was, and to take some lamb with me, being Greek, lamb, to make as many friends as possible. And I did that. I took my lamb with me and I sat down in the front row of my first lecture, which I then discovered was a wrong lecture. But I met a girl, and being Greek from an all-boys school, the only girls I knew were cousins, and they're not real girls, and so I wasn't going anywhere once I met a girl. But I want to talk about one of my first experiences as a postgraduate student and actually transferring from being becoming an academic, sort of getting into doing a PhD, expecting that sense of legitimacy will now sit with me as an academic. Like, I have now got a PhD, I've got a scholarship, I've got an APA, I'm one of these amazing sort of APA recipients, and I just expected that all the doubt in my life of me and all this sense of being an imposter was going to disappear the moment I first got my scholarship, secondly got my job as a lecturer, and thirdly, when I published my first paper. 10 years on after being a professor and winning awards and getting books published, I still have those sense of feelings. But I'll come back to that. But anyway, so one of my first days as a lecturer, I ran a unit with about 600 students. And it was in the days before we had electronic submission. You had to actually submit essays, paper hard copies. And so I turn up to the office where all the papers are held, and I walk in, and there's 600 2,000 word papers sitting there, and so essays. And I'm going, okay, so that's really good. My office is about a kilometre away, so what do I do? I'll go find something to transfer them in, which was two large recycling bins. So I grabbed the recycling bins and I turn up feeling very clever, and I made sure that they were clean. So I grab up and I sort of fill them up with these essays, and I start walking with these two bins, walking through the university like this, thinking, oh yeah, this is cool, I'm an academic. This is the glamorous life of an academic. And I get to the bottom of the stairs, and my office was at the top of the stairs, and I'm like, they were heavy, right? And I'm like, okay, what I'll do is I'll take one bin up at a time, right? So then I grab one of the bins and I start dragging it up the stairs, and I get to the top of the stairs, and I go, okay, I'll just take it into the office, and then I will just leave it in there, and I'll come back and get the other one. So I get to my office, and I get in there, unlock the office, I put it in there, and I hear this noise, which is beep, beep, beep. And I'm like, I look out the window, just in my own world. I look out the window, and it's a garbage truck, and it's a recycling garbage truck. And I'm like, Oh, so I start running back. Anyway, I did save the essays just as someone was picking them up and taking them towards the garbage truck. Now, the reason I set the scene with this essay, with this story is because I think it captures something about the postgraduate experience. It captures something about being a postgraduate and moving from, like, I suppose, the undergraduate, that sort of moment of transfer of being, I took 10 years off or 12 years off between doing my undergraduate and my postgraduate, but that moment of transfer is a really complex and frightening process. And we need to remember that when we discuss this, we're dealing with people who are terrified, who are uncertain, who do not really, who lack confidence, and are probably too scared to admit that they don't know what's going on. I felt, given the fact that I had a scholarship, I had a job, I had all these things, that I should know what's going on. And what I discovered very early on in my career, and what I still discover now, is I really have no idea what's going on. So this happened yesterday when I was in the DDoGS conference and people were using all these wonderful acronyms and other people were nodding. So I felt compelled to nod as well, like I knew what was going on. So this reminded me, again, I talked about this. Oh, man, this is bad news. So I talked about this yesterday. I thought, well, what were some of the things that I did when I had a conversation with my supervisor? And my conversations with my supervisors tended to follow one of five themes. The first one is I'm a fraud. So every time I'd go in to see my supervisor, I'd say to him, "Oh, you know, I really don't feel like I belong here. I'm a fraud. You know, it's really bad. I can't. You know, you made a mistake when you said I can do my PhD." And he'd laugh and say, "No, just go ahead and do it." And that was it. That was his sage advice. His advice was just go ahead and do it. Don't worry about it. The second conversation I had with my supervisor was I have writer's block. Which is generally what happens when you're too scared to write something, to submit, and so you use the excuse of writer's block. And every now and again, all my PhD students now use that excuse that they have writer's block. I don't believe there's such a thing as writer's block, but it's a great excuse. It's one thing that PhD students seem to hold on to when they turn up to meetings without having done any preparatory work. The third thing is I understand, and this happened yesterday at DDoGS, when people ask you a question, you say, "Yeah, I get that." Really, you have no idea what's going on, but it's what a friend of mine calls smart person syndrome. You don't want to actually admit that you don't know what's going on, and this happens all. It happens now. It happens now. And as a dean, you'd think, I thought that maybe the moment I got promoted to dean, I would magically know everything that's going on. And sometimes I sit in these meetings, people talk about things like RIF, RTS, blah, 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 all these acronyms. I'm like, yes, that's bad. That's really... No, it's good. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, yes. It's bad. It's bad. The fourth one is I cannot do this. And that often involved me sending my supervisor an email while I was in the fetal position at home. And it usually follows when you get a rejection when you're trying to publish something. And I still go through that feeling now, even though I kind of counted the number of... I don't want to say it because I sound like a dick, but anyway. Okay, and then finally, I want to change topic, or I want to change supervisors, or I want to change universities. And this is an old chestnut that I deal with as a dean all the time. Whenever students are stressed, they want to make an appointment to the dean, and whenever the first conversation begins by them saying, "I want to change universities." Okay, that's good. Which university do you want to go to? Another one. Which one? I don't know. So what do we know about the PhD? Like, given that the students are experiencing, and I think, you know, in my experience as a dean and spending so much time with PhD students, what do we know about the PhD that they're going through? Well, we do know now that 50% of postgraduates don't go into academia. And it was interesting yesterday because people yesterday at DDoGS talked about how this is not necessarily a new figure. This is definitely not a new figure. It's been like this for quite a while. So it's not something that really should surprise us. We also know now that interdisciplinary skills are highly valued, but what makes a PhD often really, really valuable is the fact that it's very specialised. And I think this is one of the things that we're concerned about. And at the postgraduate experience, I told a story, which I'll repeat now again. Apologies to those who are there. When I was doing my PhD, I was really interested in exchange systems and how exchange systems can redefine the shape of a community. And so I did a case study on six different exchange systems that that changed. I looked at the Solomon Islands, I looked at Papua New Guinea, but then I looked at how exchange systems around the privatisation of a hospital or a school or community services altered the relationships within that community. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so I gave one of my first conferences I spoke at about a conference where I spoke about this. I talked about my six different case studies, and a professor came up to me afterwards, a much more senior, much very experienced, very well published gentleman, and he said to me, I really like what you're doing. I said, oh, thanks, you know, this and that. He goes, I'm just going to give you one piece of advice. If you ever want to get a job, you're going to have to specialise more. And I'm like, oh, so what do you mean? He said, well, I think you're doing six case studies is way too much. You should do one case study. You should specialise in exchange systems in Micronesia around microfinance in the 1980s. And any time there's a job anywhere on Micronesia, on microfinance, on exchange system, or the 1980s, you will be invited. Right? And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah. And so being a specialist is something that is really highly valued within the academy, but often it's something that, again, as the Ecola report said, it's not something that translates often, doesn't easily translate into sort of broader skills. Collaboration is highly valued, but it's not something that that we're very good at teaching our students or getting our students to do. I mean, most of our PhD students, when they talk about their experience, talk about the sense of isolation. And the concept, I'm part of this postgraduate experience project team, and I'll acknowledge them in a moment, but, one of the things that no one said, not one of the interviewees said, was, it was great building collaborative networks. It was great building networks of support. No one said that. So we somehow create an environment, even though we know that we stand on the shoulders of giants and that we must collaborate to produce the best research in the world, we teach our students, or our students seem to pick up that it's an isolating, individualized experience. And this is, I think, deeply problematic. And finally, we know that we have pressure on completions and finances, again, which was captured quite well in the Ecola report. Now, the Ecola report, for those of you who have read it, and I've read it once, and it was really great. We got a really great conversation at DDoGS yesterday and some amazing research. I want to thank those who spoke about it yesterday because they were fantastic insights. They concentrate on the person, the system, and the nation. And sort of we looked at, and this is the three elements of the Ecola report: the person, which is the PhD, and how what happens, the system around them, and the benefits and the costs to the nation. Now, what comes out really clearly in the Ecola report is this tension. A tension between scholarship, curiosity-driven research, and the need for training. And this word is used, specifically training, it's almost like we're preparing people for industry. We must prepare people for industry. And I do believe that we, as a sector, need to be better at doing that, better at being able to work with industry. And when I talk about industry, I'm talking about industry, not what someone said, not holes in the ground or producing things. I'm talking about industry in the broader, talking about non-government organisations, government, and other aspects of industry. But I think that we need to be, I do think we need to be better at that. But I think I get really concerned when we talk about the word training. Right, as if it's really easy just to train someone up. It's like as if we're teaching them how to just build a brick wall. That's training. I think it's much more complex than that. So I think this was often seen as a false binary. I think there's a binary there that curiosity-driven research and scholarship is in opposition to what industry needs. Right, and it's really interesting in the work I did with Western Sydney University around setting up the Academy program. We interviewed people from everyone from human rights organisations to the armed services to people from Apple and the large consulting firms. And the most important skill that they described that they wanted from a graduate was problem definition. And as someone said, I want someone to pick up the phone and ask the right question. Right? Now, that's not training. That's something deeper. Right? That problem definition is something that is embedded within the PhD. Does not mean that research degrees do not need to change, but it does mean that it's something embedded and we just need to be better at drawing it out. So I think, I think it is a bit of a false binary, but I do also think that we need to be better at shaping and explaining what we do. Now, this, again, is not new. For those of you who remember the Ernst & Young report, they talked about the 1,000-year-old industries, which is the universities, on the cusp of profound change. A fascinating report. I mean, I hope there's no one from Ernst & Young here or no one that contributed to the report, but it was pathetic, right? And it was such a bad report. It meant it talks about closer ties to industry, but did not mention the word. It mentioned the word community and engagement twice, right? So, you know, so at the time, I remember someone talking about it and talking about a case study around, you know, like, for example, building closer relations to the car industry, car manufacturing industry. Well, that's great. That would have been great if we'd all partnered up with the car industry. They don't exist anymore in Australia, you know, and this is the kind of thing that concerns me when we start talking about training and work-ready skills. And I think this is a fallacy that we need to push back on. I'm not saying that we're not better at connecting with industry in the broader sense. I'm just saying that we need to be careful about the pathway that we go down. So we talked about a lot yesterday. We talked about the systems at DDoGS, and I'll come back to a little bit of that. And then we talked about the nation, and that is, I think sometimes that was defined a little bit yesterday as the government, and we had a representative from the government talking about from the, and he was a really nice guy, and he had a really, really tough job, but what he did was he convinced us that the government is doing everything they can to screw high degree research in this country. Like, I mean, seriously. And it was, he said, we've simplified the formula, and then he explained us how they simplified the formula. And, you know, I mean, seriously, I was in DDoGS, right? There's some of the smartest people in the world there. And I looked around, and not one person was nodding. There was no smarts people syndrome there. It was just like, everyone was just, yeah, anyway. So I don't know. So I think again, we need to acknowledge that this is the environment that we're operating in, and we know this, you know. But we can't, you know. It was interesting because one of the things yesterday was we're advertising. They're talking about changing the funding rules, and we're advertising now for PhD scholarships, and they're in. We don't know what the funding rules are going to be, and then they're talking about producing a discussion paper. But it was pretty obvious to me yesterday, and maybe I'm just a bit cynical, but it was pretty obvious to me yesterday that the discussion paper has already been written, not as a consultation paper, but as an implementation paper. And I apologise for being a little bit cynical. I think we did that. Yeah, and then finally the person, and this is our students. And I suppose I feel that there's not enough about the student, the candidate in the Ecola report, and I think that sometimes we fall short of recognising that we're dealing with these individuals who are the future of our industry, who are the future of our sector, who are the future of our country, and who are there to solve wicked problems that we, our generations, have failed to solve. And for me, this is I suppose, a letdown on some of the stuff that's been happening lately. The person, the individual, the student, and you know, and we deal with them, and universities are terrible at dealing with students. I'm going to show some quotes later on. But as employers of students, and most students come and work for us as casuals or as tutors or as sessional staff, we treat them so badly. We treat them so badly. And, you know, I remember myself, I mean, I only graduated 9 years ago, and I remember being a casual at a university and saying to the dean at the time I was dealing with, you know, I cannot, you know, what can I do to extend my contract over summer? Because I find it really hard to survive over summer with no casual teaching. And he said, nothing. And at least he wasn't, I mean, it was a refreshing breath away from hypocrisy, who usually people would say, oh, we'll see what we can do, but no one ever does anything. And I think we need to recognise the fact that, you know, $26,500 a year is not, in Sydney, Melbourne, anywhere in Australia, is not really that great a lifestyle, right? Anyway, so that's just me. Maybe I'm living above my station, I don't know. I'm conscious of time. So the third thing is the changing environment. And, you know, and I put up this slide, and I apologise for those who have seen it. That's me, in case you don't recognise me. But that's my iPhone 5, which in itself is obsolete, and I'm holding Australia's first mobile phone, which weighed 10 kilos, had a charge time of 8 minutes and a talk time of, sorry, 8 hours and a talk time of 10 minutes. And I think about that's the world, that was a generation ago. And I ask my students in class, what would you rather lose? Your phone or your wallet, you know, when I was their age, how could you lose your phone? It was stuck to the wall in your house. But now most of my students will say they'd much rather lose their wallet than their phone, right? And this is, I just think that one example captures how radically different the world is. Anyway, so I'm going to skip that. Okay, so now, so universities, I think, are at a point of profound change, and I think we are where newspapers and record labels were, a generation ago, where we still control, not to a large extent, but what made us powerful is that we controlled content. We no longer control content. Wikipedia pages produce more pages than what universities do, and so we might not agree with that content, but it's there, right? It's everywhere, and we're only one voice of many. And I have had the situation lining up for a coffee with my students in front of the coffee cart, and hearing two of my students saying that classes had been cancelled for this week, and I'm saying, no, they hadn't, and they're like, yes, it has. I'm like, I'm the lecturer, and they said, yeah, but we read it on Facebook that it's cancelled. I was like, how do you argue with that, Well, you don't. You just say, cool, let's have a holiday. So, I sit there and I say, what's our value proposition? And I'm sorry, my background is in economics, so every now and again, my neoliberal side, my undercover neoliberal side sneaks in. But, if we just rely on the fact that we offer degrees as our value proposition, then we are falling behind. We are going to be in for a rude shock. So I think within the next decade, Google University or Apple University or some university that appears out of nowhere is really going to be taking us front on. And there's estimates now that something like 20% of universities around the world will disappear in the next decade, right? And if that's transferred to Australia, we'll lose something like 8 to 10 universities. So so within this sector, within this environment, what are we doing for our PhD students? What are we preparing them for? What world are we preparing them for? And I sometimes think that we're not keeping up. So I think that sometimes we're failing our PhD students, our higher degree research students, in a time of disruption. And I apologise if you saw this slide last week or the week before. A PhD was established in the 1880s in Germany, and I always think about what would these dudes say if they saw this, right? And they, and this is a path, this is the kind of the way that a PhD was developed and structured, and it really hasn't changed a huge amount, that 3-year journey. And I don't know about your experience, but my experience doing in my relationship with my supervisors, I really did feel like I was in Germany in the 1880s. But okay, so the person. So again, now I want to acknowledge the wonderful Sally Kift and the wonderful work that the postgraduate experience is doing, and she sort of assisted me with these slides and gave me some information. So I want to acknowledge that. And so, we do a lot of work on first-year experience for undergraduate students, but there's very little work done on postgraduates. And there's a current project happening funded by or part of an OLT grant that's looking at the postgraduate experience, especially around first years, both coursework and research. And we're very bad at sort of recording what students are experiencing. And we know about undergrads that their experience generally tends to be an experience of dissatisfaction, of confusion, and so on. It takes them a while to settle in. And I know from my own experience that, I failed, I think, 5 out of my first 8 subjects at university. And the main reason I failed for a bunch of reasons. One's because I discovered girls, but two, because I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea who to ask. Now, universities have got much better in the last 3 decades, but again, right, we must acknowledge the fact that it's a really confusing time. And we know that about undergrads, but there's very little research being done on postgraduates. And so we translate very, how much of that translates to the first year experience for postgrads? Now, in the research, and I will, like I said, OLT, Bond, ASA, Kappa, USQ, VU, and James Cook, and specifically Sally, and the wonderful, I've got a mental blank now, but she's wonderful. The discussion that we had last week was really fascinating. And in the survey, this is some of the data that started coming out, where, it was really interesting. We received all this official information about how great the postgrad experience was in Australia, and then this is the data that started coming out from our research project. And it's found, really strikingly, that the vast majority of staff and students experience their higher degree research journey, and they're pretty unsatisfied with it, right? And that's pretty, these are pretty damning statistics, where, almost 60% of students do not have a positive experience. 21% are neutral. So if you combine that, only one in five actually feels that their PhD experience or their higher degree research experience is positive. They're pretty damning statistics, right? They're not great statistics. Now, this research has got a little bit of way to go, and but we're interested to see what the final numbers say. But these are not good numbers, and not numbers we necessarily should be proud of. And here's some feedback, which I think is just worth reading. So I'll drink, you read. Okay. It's got little bubbles in it. That's nice. The word struggle to balance, not a lot of support, experience is hard, obviously there's a lot of stress. But I suppose in the longer term, you know, there's things around time, flexibility, learning the work-life balance and so on. So these are some of the words from our students. Another student describing themselves as feeling like a lone ranger running, not always with the support you need and not always knowing where to find that and how to get it. So not to sound silly, but these are not first year undergraduate students who are totally lost. This is our postgraduate students who have been through, you know, usually have got either had a career or have done very well at undergrad. So, and they're feeling this, right? And so it just shows, again, that the systems around them tend to be failing. And staff who were also interviewed as part of this program, see the students as frightened and lonely. And yeah, they eventually get there, but they talk about the staff who deal with the students. So these are the frontline staff, some of the directors, who talk about how difficult it is, and they're recognising that, you know, that these students are feeling isolated and terrified. So how to respond? So I want to talk about a little bit about how we're responding at Western Sydney University. This is very much a project in process, okay? So I was appointed acting dean on the 1st of July, and I was appointed ongoing dean on the 1st of January. I think I'm the only one that applied for the job, but you take what you can get, right? So how to respond? Okay, so this is some of the stuff that we're doing. And this, I suppose, goes back to the idea of what Robert was saying about transferable skills and knowledge. And so what I think universities are very good at is during the undergraduate or the postgraduate experience, we're very good at promoting the students gain knowledge. And I put this slide up last time as well, but this is not really what the journey looks like. It looks much more like this. And during this time, we're very good at getting the students to pick up knowledge, like research knowledge and things like that. But what I argue is that that's only half the picture. We need to actually promote a sense of skills. The research and knowledge and that is not negotiable, right? Research excellence is not negotiable. Nothing I say here questions the need for research excellence, okay, and all that type of thing. But I also argue that we need to be promoting a new set of skills that we really do encourage our students to make these skills transferable. And when I say the culture, I'm talking about the culture to be able to adapt to this rapidly changing world, which is not always easy because, as we know, in our universities and our institutions and our sector, which is going through rapid change, we're not very good at adapting often, you know. And the number of people that say to me, I'm not, you know, can you show me how to use Blackboard? Because I've never used it, I've avoided using it for the last 8 years, is pretty shocking, right? And again, I'm sure that's not a unique experience to me only. So what skills? Look, this is a program that I've been working on over the last 5 or 6 years. So someone's taking a photo, sorry. So these are the skills that I've been working on over the last 5 or 6 years. This is my Citizen Scholar program, which I've just had a book come out. it's exorbitantly priced. It's like $100 a pop, so don't buy it. But if you want, email me and I'll give you the first chapter for free, and the second chapter, and the third chapter, any chapter you want. They are proofs, so I'm not breaking copyright. But your university should buy it. Your library should definitely buy it, at least 10 copies. So I won't get into each of these, but they include things like, and this is going to sound really silly, right? Like things like aesthetics, right? What do we do to promote this sense of aesthetics or of beauty amongst our cohorts? And someone says, why do people need to know about aesthetics? Well, we live in a world where, when was the last time we purchased something or that was ugly but useful? Everything in our society now is somehow linked to aesthetics. And so, again, we need to recognise that there's been this massive cultural shift, and there's nothing, again, that we do to promote this kind of concept. I've got entrepreneurial, critical thinking, adaptability, mistakeability, learning from our mistakes, building resilience, that kind of thing. And I, for those of you who heard this example before, I do apologise. This idea of one of the things I talk about, and I think that the research journey should be promoting all these. I don't think it's separate. I think it's embedded in the journey. We just need to bring it out. And I'll briefly talk about how we're trying to do it at Western Sydney University, which, as I said, is a work in progress. So one of the examples I use is this idea of new literacy. And this came out really clearly in the ECOLA report, which said that, and it also came out in a report from the Australian the Foundation for Young Australians, FYA. This came out a report that dealing with data is becoming a massive challenge, and this is a massive skill that our students are lacking, and it's not something that we're very good at getting our students to think about, and our students resist it. Like if they're doing a PhD on literature or something else, they're like, why do I need to learn about data, you know? And so we also need to be good to not only build this into the journey, but actually take our PhD students or take our higher degree research students with us. And I talk about literacy now including this ability, not just reading and writing and arithmetic, or the three R's that aren't, but also the idea of working with big amounts of data and what that actually means and being data literate. And look, and again, I talk about when I was at university having a lecture in economics and being told that there was one, you know, given an essay question about Australia's manufacturing policy and being told there was one book in the library that you could access. This is going back in 1987, one book in the library that you could access that will give you all the answers that you need for the essay. And so everybody leaves the lecture at the same time, running towards the library, only to be met by the scariest people in the world who seem to just always get jobs at Closed Reserve and lining up and them just sort of giving you their library card and telling you you had 10 minutes. So you ran off and you photocopied the whole book just in case you needed it, but you didn't, but you just in case you did. And then everybody's standing around you wanting to photocopy your photocopy of their photocopy. And so it was a time of information scarcity, and we've moved from scarcity to information abundance. So how good are our students at dealing with this amazing amount of information? So, some of the things that we're doing is we're trying to build a scaffolded journey. And this is the kind of journey that I inherited with my students. And this is where I say that the 1880s journey isn't that different, which is essentially that we had a three-month candidature plan, a 12-month confirmation of candidature, ethics if it was required, an annual progress report, and then the submission. And that's a pretty sparse experience, right? And again, this is why we're looking at this 1880s model. You know, what's changed? So what we're trying to build is a scaffolded journey whereby we have a lot more requirements all the way through. This does not add extra work, but what it does, it requires the students to engage, to interact, to build networks, to work with us at much more regular intervals. And I'm happy to supply these slides to anyone, so feel free to, but take photos if you want, it's cool. It's sort of the way, when you're giving a presentation, people take photos of your slides. It's a way of thinking, oh, I've got something interesting to say. So even if I've got nothing interesting to say, please feel free to take photos because it makes me feel better. Just moving on. Okay, and then around that, what we're trying to do is we're trying to build a certificate, a graduate certificate of what we haven't, of something like, of knowledge translation and innovation. And so what we're doing is around each of these key milestones, and we're building many, many more key milestones, is we're building subjects where they actually have to produce something for those subjects, and those, what they're producing is directly linked with their research journey at the same time, if that makes sense. So it's again touching much more on the experience, having a lot more contact points, and building that scaffolded so we can then make interventions if we see them, if something comes up or if there's any problems. Including in this is about the 18-month mark you'll see there, which is roughly about the 18-month mark. Everyone breathe. Okay, so one of the things that we're doing is trying to build in career planning. And again, look, I think career planning, again, it comes out as being this really interesting, and this, I think this is a really great discussion yesterday at DDoS. We talked about how often, you know, 50% of students go here and 50% of students go there, like they're two separate things and that they never interact. But what we really know is that, you know, hopefully we can create an environment where people can move between these different industries, and someone with great industry experience, and again, I talk about industry more than just digging holes in the ground, coming to universities and then people from universities going into that, and creating, and even if they're like 6 months appointment as you know, as a temporary or adjunct or something like that, where they can come in and teach. And I think this, they need to build a much more fluid environment. Also need to, I think we also need to recognise the fact that the growth of the not just academic and professional staff, but the hybrid staff member, the staff member who's got a PhD but chooses not to become an educator or a researcher and goes into policy work within the university. And we've got a bunch of those in our university. We got someone here who's one of those people right now, and she's an amazing literacy, works with our students on building their literacy, but she's an amazing academic as well. And so we need, as universities, to be better at sort of recognising. But the stuff that we're doing around career planning is recognising the fact that you do need specific skills or knowledge to get into some of these other industries. So one of the examples we're talking at the moment is in this sort of non-government policy stream, where we've got the Whitlam Institute based at our university. And one of the things we're organising with the Whitlam Institute is any student who is doing a policy, public policy, based research project, then spends at the end, after they submit, we'll spend 6 months or 3 months with those guys, between 3 and 6 months with those guys, and we'll produce a policy paper, a policy discussion paper, mentored by the amazing policy analysts within the Whitlam Institute. So I think that's a kind of really hands-on and amazing skills that we're trying to build, which is not, you know, just, you know, sort of saying, oh, well, industry is something magical over there. Often there's amazing things happening in our university which you need to take advantage of. Okay. Knowledge translation just means that we just need to get our students to communicate better. And, you know, here's a model that's about knowledge translation, but essentially it talks about, I think the 3MT is one good example of knowledge translation. But one of the things I'm pushing for, haven't quite got there yet, but one of the things I'm pushing for is I want all our students to actually go to primary schools and actually do like a 5-minute presentation to like 10-year-olds. And I figured if you can make your PhD cool to a 10-year-old, then you understand knowledge translation. Right, that's I think the ultimate example. So so they're the kind of things we're trying to build into the PhD journey. I kind of haven't got a chance. I'll sort of won't touch on this a lot, but I think there's also a lot of work to do on supervisor development, which Robert talked about before I got on. And I think the supervisor development stuff has been left in the dark for too long. And look, you know, the graduate school at Western Sydney U is only like just over a year old. And I think, you know, I think what I've discovered in that time, and I like to describe our graduate school as an activist school. We actually go out and actually, you know, be quite active and tell supervisors what we expect from them and let them know that we are not happy when we're not happy with them, yeah? And that's really tough. That's tough dealing with really senior professors who are really successful, but we're discovering that sometimes they can be really crappy supervisors, right? And you've got to be really brave enough to do that. And the problem is that within the university power dynamic, if you've got a higher degree research director who's a lecturer, a senior lecturer, they're not in a position to go into the professor and say, you're a crappy supervisor, right? And so I think we need to be able to build those systems in and really kind of, you know, demand supervisor development away from the tick the box. I know that people at UTS are doing some great work around this as well, which I want to acknowledge. So, I mean, this is the kind of the model that we have with our, you know, the sort of research, training, engagement, administration that we expect from our staff and our supervisors. And that's, you know, let's acknowledge that people are under a lot of pressure and they're trying to produce, they're trying to teach, they're trying to do stuff online, they're trying to engage with the community or industry and so on. And then on top of that, we expect them to be really, really good supervisors, right? So we need to kind of embed this as part of the journey rather than sort of saying, oh, by the way, you also need to be a good supervisor. And I think the COLA report picks that up. So finally, just to quickly finish up, look, you also need to build in many formal and informal feedback loops, and this is some of the feedback loops that we're trying to build in. But I think it's also informal loops. There needs to be a lot of informal loops. And one of the things that we're doing, and it sounds really naff when I talk about it, but I think it's been one of the most profound changes in the relationship between the graduate school and the students, is we hold informal lunches with students across every campus every semester. And all that does, it creates a two-way informal communication. And sometimes students will say this to you informally that they won't say to you formally. And you can make these kind of informal interventions rather than having to do something a bit more formal. And I think that's really important, because sometimes if you move in too quickly in a formal way, it can actually aggravate any negative experience that's beginning to emerge. And look, and finally, the last thing is, I think we really need to be better at defining expectations. And you know, and look, I love a good marketing brochure as much as the next guy. Like, seriously, I get really excited when I go to a university and I pick up their marketing brochure, and it says something. When you come to this university, you'll have unique XYZ university experience. Your XYZ university experience will translate into you having fun and making friends. And look, I love those brochures. They really excite me. I want to go to that university after I read them. But they don't really outline the expectations, especially for international students, what we really, really expect from them. What can they expect? What are the cultural expectations that we have within Australia that could be radically different to what other universities or other cultures have? And one of the things I've learned in my current position, in a way that I suppose I never really understood before, is that each PhD student is incredibly, their journey and where they're coming from, what their ambitions are, where they want to go next, why they're doing it, what they're doing is an individualised journey. So while some of it is generic, a lot of it is really individual. And we really need to be able to say really up front, explain what our expectations are on them and what they should expect from us. And one of the things that we did speak about at DDoGS yesterday was the Ombudsman's report, the New South Wales Ombudsman's report, that talked about where things go wrong for students. And over the last 6 months or 8 months, I've dealt with situations where, you know, things have gone wrong. And it's often, you know, and often when you start unpacking things, it's obviously no individual person's fault. There's this massive expectation that was never met, right? Or misaligned expectations. And I think the Ombudsman's report, while it's not perfect and has some problems with it, makes some really, really good points about how to manage those expectations. And one of the things that I've learned is having an independent person to come along. And one of the things that we've done at Western Sydney is often get other academics from other universities, asking them to come in and step in and assess the situation or be there as part of the meetings. And people say, when we were talking about this yesterday, said, well, how do you feel about putting your dirty laundry out from someone from another university? And I'm like, well, actually, what I'm really worried about is a student. And if we can come up with a process that assists a student, then a little bit of dirty laundry in public will quickly disappear, as long as we have a chance of ensuring that the student's expectations are being met. So, to finish off, I suppose what I really want to say is I don't think we need to reify the postgraduate process. The idea of the 3 year student going off and doing their thing and coming back with these light bulb moments and all that, you know, that is not a realistic expectation. And it's not a realistic experience. And, you know, and all you got to do is talk to the postgraduate representatives about some of the nightmare experiences that they've had. And, you know, I don't want to get into it here for obvious reasons, but some of the stories that the PhD students share with me, both within my university and outside, is pretty horrifying. And I think, you know, and as a sector, I think sometimes we should be ashamed of it. So we shouldn't reify that this is the way that it was done in Germany in 1880, and it's the way we should do it now. But nothing I say should actually undermine the need for research excellence. The second thing is, I think we need to contextualise the PhD in the contemporary world. And then I think I kind of hopefully made that argument quite clear. But like I said, nothing that I say should undermine the standards that we as that we need to hold and uphold. And one of the things that I know that at the last DDoGS meeting that we had this really great conversation that said that sometimes students are under so much pressure and supervisors are under so much pressure that sometimes people are sending out PhDs without them being fully finished, or, you know, without them being ready to go out because of that pressure. And one of the things that we agreed on, and this was it wasn't a formal part of the discussion, but it was on the side, was that, you know, if I get a PhD that's underdone, I want to send it back. And I think that one of the things that we need to do is make sure that we maintain those quality, recognise the fact that pressures are there, but we should never actually, and that's one of the things that Ecolas recognised, was the excellence in the quality of the research produced. So that's all I've got to say. Thank you.